Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Surgery Endorsement Maintenance Work Group A conference call. And before we get started, I just wanted to see if there were any other measure developers on the call. I know we have representation from STS with Jane Hahn on the call, and we have John Bott from ARC, as well as Laura Eaton from Ingenix. Are there any other measure developers on the call? Okay, I would like to turn the call over to Melinda Murphy.
Thanks, Alexis. So just quickly, the group having done this before, you know that the goal of the meeting is to review and clarify within the work group any of the comments or ratings that you gave as preliminary as you reviewed the measures in preparation for the steering committee. And also in doing that, you will have the opportunity, if there's anything that you want to hear more about or have question about that you believe should be brought to the steering committee at the time of its meeting, it's an opportunity to give those developers who are online the information so that they're prepared to do that. And again, as in the previous call, there is no expectation, nor have we asked that the developers prepare anything for today's call. So it's just an opportunity. If you have something you want to give them a heads up about for the steering committee, you have the opportunity to do that. Any questions or comments about the goals for the activity? Okay, Dr. Torchiana, is there anything that you would want to say as the group, to the group as we get started then?
No, thanks, Linda. I think we're pretty much getting to be good at this stuff, so I think we can just go right to it.
Okay, so then recall at the steering committee meeting what each of the leads will do is present the measure by number, title, a brief description, the evaluation within the group and the individual evaluation with the rationale, raise any issues or concerns for discussion by the entire group, and know that one of the things that we will be doing at the steering committee meeting is getting a clear statement of the rationales with respect to the way in which a measure meets each of the criteria. So that said, then we're ready to start with the measures. And Alexis, the plan, since Paula Grayling is not able to join and John Morton is not joining, how do you want to approach those?
I think we can just discuss them as a group. I guess one of us, you or I, could read off the description of the measure to begin the discussion.
Okay, has everyone looked at measure 127 at the ratings overall?
It's Dr. Stafford. Alexis, I still haven't gotten that email. I'm not sure what's happening.
Okay, let me try and send it to you again.
Okay,
sent out at 3:03 Eastern time, so I'll send it again. It's no problem.
Okay, I just rebooted everything, and it's for some reason it's not showing up.
So I'm going to go ahead and mention what the overall ratings were for 127 while we're seeing if we can get this one document transmitted. So this is the measure on preoperative beta blockade, an STS measure. The group, as each member of the group, identified the measure as important. Comments were a nice summary of the literature, potential for significant impact, significant performance gap, and a second comment, solid evidence for utility of the measure. So importance, unless there's something someone wanted to bring out in particular about that, doesn't seem to be at question in any way.
I would agree with that. I mean, I think everybody, this is pretty much the standard, so I don't think there's any issues with that in terms of importance. Alexis, I just got your email. Thank you.
Okay, great.
Okay, then scientific acceptability. All but two people identified that as completely met, and the two people who marked it otherwise said partially. There were a number of comments. Do you have, I'm trusting, actually, that everyone has the document before them or is able to see it on the screen that that Jessica has up. So a number of comments there, one related to contraindications appearing not to be clearly defined, one asking about inflation of the denominator and whether the database specifies what are acceptable contraindications, one related to lack of specification related to exclusions. And those were the sum total of the comments. So discussion about scientific acceptability.
Melinda, I don't have the things in front of me, but I remember what I wrote about them, and you can fill me in if I forget something that I wrote down. This is Dr. Dutton.
Okay. And on that particular one, you had noted exclusions not specified, expressing the rate of exclusions in prior data would provide reassurance that the measure is not being distorted, but might show that there is no need for the exclusion at all. So, Dr. Dutton.
I'm sorry, I would say we should just ask the developers to give us the data on how many people are excluded from the measure. If it turns out it's less than 1%, then, first of all, we don't have to worry much about the contraindications, and second, we should recommend that they just remove the contraindications as part of the measure.
Okay, so Jane is on, and I'm sure she'll take that request back.
I'm sorry, I'm a little confused as to what the question is. We didn't provide data on the exclusions, or?
I was wondering how many patients were excluded.
It's provided in the form. It's 144,060 patients were the total, and of those, a little over 5,000 were excluded.
So 3.5%.
Right, 3.65%.
Okay, thank you.
Sure, not a problem.
So that maybe, though, still leaves the question as to, you know, that it seems to be left to the discretion of the physician to decide whether there's a contraindication and whether there should be, you know, whether that's of concern or whether that's appropriate. I guess that's the question.
So this is Dave Corchin, I guess, just chiming up on that one, which comes into play for any of these medication scenarios, which are pretty common in a lot of the cardiac quality measures. I think with the case of beta blockers, at least the exclusions are pretty clear. And I guess the reason to not be more prescriptive about what exclusions are acceptable and what should be excluded is that when it's a relatively rare event that someone is excluded, then sometimes the exclusion criteria get a little bit idiosyncratic. I mean, obviously the principal one is some kind of sinus node dysfunction or bradycardia for beta blockers, and that I guess that's manifest in many different ways. And trying to define it more precisely when the exclusion is used infrequently, maybe isn't a real constructive piece of additional effort.
I'm fine with it as it is.
Okay, so then any other discussion about scientific acceptability, ready to go to usability? Everyone in the work group identified usability as completely met and had no comments. There was a question about cost for data abstraction, the FTE.
Yeah, I had that, Renee. I had that in the feasibility part, and that was the only question that I really had.
Okay, so this was that you would like to see that provided at the okay. And then the other comment about feasibility was Dr. Dutton's, determining degree of pre-op use can be challenging, especially in systems with poor EHP adaptation. This likely requires substantial registrar time to confirm.
Yes, just the concern that the registrar will have to spend a lot of time figuring out if the patient has been on the medication before coming into the hospital. And if you don't have a good EHR with an electronic medication reconciliation process, that could be challenging.
I guess, though, I would wonder whether that's not also caught up in the mandates around medication reconciliation anyway. I mean, I would guess there's fewer initiatives more important than establishing a credible list of medications, especially for something as significant as heart surgery.
Okay, and then any other comments, and there are just a couple of things that that the developer will be expecting to provide at the meeting, and if there are any other comments, we can go on to the next one. At this point, without Paul Grayling, I just have to assume that everybody who's reviewed them and has additional comments that aren't reflected in the table will be brought forward in your discussion. So the next one then is 284, surgery patients on beta blocker therapy prior to admission who received a beta blocker during the perioperative period. And everyone identified this as an important measure. Renee, you did have a comment about quartile data with descriptive statistics.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would just, they should be able to have that data, and I just wondered if this developer had it. It would be nice to see that in the document. It makes it a little easier to look at performance gaps and things, but that's my only comment about that.
Okay, so doesn't affect your feeling about the importance. We'd just like to see that information.
We'd like to see it.
And then with respect to scientific acceptability, there were three individuals who identified, am I looking at this correctly, two people who identified this as partially the others as completely met. Carol, do you want to make any comment about the note regarding the denominator?
Sure. The denominator was referenced that they were on a beta blocker prior to arrival, and that prior to arrival seemed like a pretty vague comment. Is 2 weeks ago prior to arrival? Is it a week ago? Is it a day ago? Is it an hour ago? You know, it seemed like there should be more precision around what prior to arrival means.
Do you have a suggestion?
I don't know what the proper time period would be, but it just seemed like a pretty general statement, and that could be subject to a lot of interpretations. So I guess from my perspective, having something consistent, and probably STS would be in a better position than I to recommend what that time period would be.
I think this one's a general surgery CMS recommendation, if I'm not mistaken, though. So
is this one not STS? Is this one general surgery?
It is. It's one of the skip measures.
Okay. Okay.
And I think
also wrote an observation on the same topic for all of these medication process measures. A different way to look at all of these would be, why not measure the outcome of adequate heart rate control? And beta blockers probably do have some other effects, so maybe giving the medication is actually important. But for this one, could you get a passing grade by giving every patient 1 milligram of atenolol post-op, a single dose?
And we have the measure developer, Wanda Johnson, on the call, so she'll be taking notes and making sure that she can answer your questions at the in-person meeting.
I mean, I think my understanding of this, and I'm far from expert, but my understanding of this particular measure is that this area is still, I think, a bit of a controversial area. And whether or not, as pointed out, whether some kind of measure of heart rate is necessary, and whether in low-risk patients beta blockers actually present any outcome benefit, I think remains a bit of a controversial subject. There's been a few very provocative and interesting editorial exchanges on this subject in the literature in the last couple of years, and what had seemed like a fairly cut-and-dried measure, I think, is actually now a little bit more of a controversial one, and the issue around heart rate versus just the existence of a beta blocker is one, and then the question of high-risk versus low-risk population, I think, is one of the others. There's actually some evidence that beta blockers in low-risk populations are potentially riskier than not using them at all.
It's Renee. I think you're right, and there is a lot of controversy. I think the key thing about this measure is that it's beta blockers for patients who were already on them when they came in, so they want to make sure they don't get stopped.
Yeah.
Because that data is clear.
That's a good point.
Is clearer, anyway. You shouldn't stop them if they were on them. So as long as we keep that for this measure, which is a measure, I just went back and looked at it again to make sure I had read it right, then I think that kind of takes that part out of the picture. Starting them on somebody who wasn't on them is a whole other issue.
But if I'm not mistaken, I don't think there's probably enough information in the studies that are out there to refine it down to a heart rate issue as to what represents adequate control versus inadequate control. So maybe something around a definition of something other than a homeopathic dose of a beta blocker might be one way to approach that. But I don't know if it's actually been firmly demonstrated that, like a resting heart rate of 60 or something like that is what the desired target is.
I think you're right. I think that's still somewhat up in the air. And some studies will say 60 to 80.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty wide range. So I think the bottom line is that if they were on it, it should be continued. And if you can continue it at the dose they were on or an equivalent IV dose, then that's appropriate. But beyond that, you know, they might have been on it pre-op and still not be controlled.
Yep.
That's true, too.
This is probably the best measure we can have in the area now, but in the long run, all of these medication process measures should give way to an outcome measure.
Absolutely.
Okay. Are you ready to move on to the discussion of usability? And two individuals spoke to the question of harmonization. Oh, you know, Renee, we did not address your comments about laparoscope.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about that. I was curious about, and maybe the developer can help us, why the laparoscope was included in the denominator. I guess they just wanted to make sure that they could catch all of the operative codes, but they should have been able to catch that in the ICD-9 codes.
Okay, so that'll go forward to the steering committee. And you also have a note that patients who died in the perioperative period are excluded.
Right, and I wondered about that because one of the reasons to keep patients on it is that there's some data to suggest that in the periop period, in this period in general, and we had this issue with one of the measures from the last time, it's how they're defining the periop period. If it's just in the first 24 hours, then it's not a big deal, but if they're concluding the periop period is the whole time they're in the hospital, and they die and they weren't on beta blockers, then you're going to miss a patient that you should have seen there was an issue with.
I agree.
So I'd like to have them tell us what their definition of periop period is.
I think that is in the write-up, and I think it goes through 24 hours. It's under 2A2. It's 24 hours prior to surgery through discharge from the post-anesthesia care recovery area.
Oh, okay, so I missed that.
So it is there.
Although, interestingly enough, oh, that's right, because that's now, but after input from the TEP, they're actually going to change this and change the periop time frame.
Okay.
And we'll expand it, and they're going to use calendar days, so who knows?
Yeah, that's a good point.
So I think we need to have that clarified at the meeting.
Okay. And is there any other discussion from among the group about the comments that have been made or anything else related to scientific acceptability before we move on to usability? Then we'll move on to usability. And there was, again, a couple of comments related to harmonization not being addressed in the face of the fact that there are other beta blocker measures. And Dr. Dutton, you said should be integrated with similar measures in cardiac surgery.
Yep.
Any discussion of the group further about those comments or anything else related to usability? And the steering committee will look at harmonization of measures that are related or similar. So there will be that activity at the steering committee meeting. Okay. Then feasibility.
So I had a couple of comments. I when it comes to the electronic sources, they say they can't, and they're going to retool this measure, but I don't understand right now why they can't get it. It doesn't somehow make sense to me, unless it's just the way they've got things set up in the way it's measured, but it just doesn't quite make sense to me. And they're not including it in the list for future retooling. As everybody's moving to electronic health records, to have somebody go by hand through an electronic medical record is silly if they can't abstract it directly.
Well, not everybody has CPOE yet.
No, I understand completely. But you don't even need to necessarily have CPOE to get the data. And again, I think your point is well taken. It's going to depend on how everybody's systems are set up. A lot of people have an electronic medical record but still don't have CPOE. So I just wondered if by doing that, they end up excluding facilities who do have an electronic medical record. That was my only question. Or if they just literally have somebody abstract from the medical record chart. I guess that's probably what happens. And if that is the case, that then gets to my other comment about 4D. They don't identify any susceptibility to inaccuracies, and if somebody is literally abstracting data that was performed by someone other than the person getting the original information, so if you've got somebody who's abstracting data, there are always potentials for inaccuracies in terms of, you know, how they code it, what they're looking for in a rater reliability. So they just didn't address that in 4D.
Okay, so that'll go forward to the steering committee for the measure developer to speak to at the meeting. Did others on the panel have any additional comments related to feasibility that the group should be discussing at this point? Okay, then it looks like you're ready to move on to 117, and that's Renee Stafford.
Yep, that one's mine. So this measure is beta blockade at discharge, and I believe it's not up front, but I believe this was an STS measure, if I remember correctly. It would be nice to have the steward of the measure right up on the front of these forms. I'm pretty sure this was an STS measure.
It is STS. Okay. It's in the agenda.
Okay. Oh, thank you. I've got two screens open. I can't open the other one.
Understood.
Okay, so percentage of patients age 18 years and older undergoing isolated coronary artery bypass graft who were discharged on beta blockers. So this is only beta blockade at discharge. It has nothing to do with whether they were on them when they came in or not. And I think everybody pretty much felt that this, in fact, everybody did, thought that this was important to measure. There were clear performance gaps. There was one question Dr. Dutton had about whether the measure is topped out in terms of accomplishing its goal. And if we could look at that data. So if you look at the question about that, if you look at the data, it's in 1B2 where they give the quartiles. So the median value is actually 96.9, which is actually pretty high, but it drops off fairly rapidly. So I'm not sure that it's totally topped out yet.
Okay.
So my thought was, and I looked at that because I wondered that at first when I looked at it, but that's why it's nice to have the quartiles because it gives you an idea how rapidly things drop off.
Good point. I just looked at the 96.9.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you get down, you know, it drops off by almost 4% in the next quartile. So it's still a fairly, there's still 10% of the patients who are less than 90%. So I think it's reasonable from that standpoint. Does anybody else have any other comments? All right. I think we can then move on to scientific acceptability. Lots of comments here. In fact, pretty much there were about three and three, three partially and three completely. Dr. Dutton. So patients with contraindications, and you had this in several of your other ones too, and this gets back to whether the contraindications are objectively defined. And I think we pretty much talked about that in the first discussion. Do you have anything different that we need to say about that?
No, I'm satisfied with that. If it's a I agree with Dr. Torchiana. If it's a relatively low rate, but not real low, I mean, if it's real low, there's no point in having the exclusion.
Right, right.
If it's low, but not real low, there's no point in trying to define it overly objectively because it's wasted energy.
Could we ask the STS developer what percent of exclusions are here? Because I'm going to guess it's going to be higher in the post-op period because of the incidence of bradycardia, and maybe some people still think that poor ventricular function is a contraindication. Do we know the percentage of exclusions?
This is Jane Hunt from STS. Of 140,000 patients, 4,400, roughly 4,400 were excluded.
So it's about the same number.
Right.
So it's not really any different. That's still around 3%.
Yeah. So, yeah, at that level, I don't think it needs too much more effort.
We do also provide in our training manual that's provided to the data managers and to the physicians specifics and further rules and guidelines to use while they're collecting the data. So it provides a little bit more explanation than just the simple word contraindication, if that helps. So if you wanted to see that, I can definitely send that to everybody before the steering committee meeting.
That would be great.
Sure.
All right. And then I think I was the only other one that had some comments, and it may just be that it was data that didn't get filled in. The numerator time window wasn't listed. Is it the same as the denominator, or
it's just at discharge?
At discharge,
right?
Okay, okay. And then there was no risk adjustment done. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And is there any reason? Have you all thought about that, or
that I can't answer. Dr. Shaheen will be attending the meeting on our behalf, so I'm sure he can explain that in further detail.
Yeah, that would be lovely to hear about.
Sure.
And then finally, just gets to 2H, which is the disparities. There really wasn't anything that talked about it in other than reporting of the previous disparities, which you did. I'd kind of like to know what your plans are for how you're going to use that data. I mean, is anybody going to actually say, okay, well, we measured it, so we don't have to do anything with it, or are there plans to target populations? Because there clearly are some disparities in the data, and the charts are great.
Sure. I can definitely take that question back to our leadership and then have them prepare a response.
Great. And that was my only kind of question about that.
Thank you.
All right. Anybody else? Any other questions? All right.
It's Melinda. I'll add one thing with respect to measures being topped out and the issue of disparities. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I know we're going to ask the steering committees to take a look at for any measures that appear to be topped out, to look at the subpopulations to see whether or not there are some disparities that would argue for continuing the measure as it is or further tailoring it to look at the disparities.
Yeah, I think that's great. All right, then let's move on. Usability, looks like everybody was satisfied with the usability. Everyone said completely. If anybody doesn't have any further comments, we can go on to the feasibility. And I pretty much, so there were a few questions. I just was curious again about costs for data abstraction. I think all the measure developers just need to keep that in mind. A lot of this can get fairly onerous and
I can actually respond to that question right now. Okay. It's an approximate 500 cases per FPE. So that's kind of what we've just for our data collection for the adult cardiac database.
Great. 700 cases per
FPE. We're estimating about 500.
500. Yes. Okay, great.
And I can add that to the form.
That's
if Alexis
perfect.
Wants to follow up with me after the call, I can definitely
that. Would
that.
Be great.
Sure.
That would be great. And it'll just give hospitals an idea. If they're gonna participate, then it'll give them an idea up front what they're gonna need to do and who they'll need to hire.
Absolutely.
And then Dr. Dutton, you had some questions about how do we know the patients are actually taking the meds, and it gets back to your question about measuring resting heart rate. And I think those are the outcome measures that eventually we're gonna have to get at.
And I confess that was inspired by looking at the next measure.
Mm-hmm.
On the surface is exactly the same thing, but with a different way of gathering the data, it's 25 percentage points different in outcome.
It is. It's very interesting. It's very interesting. And I suspect that it has to do with, you know, the proprietary Ingenix database is only for people that actually have prescription benefits. So it's an interesting point, and I think a lot of the measures are moving towards that. It's not whether the Lovenox was ordered for DVT prophylaxis, but actually going to the record to see that it was administered.
Well, so that's the thing about Ingenix is obviously you have to not only fill the prescription, but you then also do have to take it.
Right.
So, you know, it is ultimately about heart rate probably, but there's no simple data source for that one.
Exactly.
To state the obvious. I'm sorry about my background noise. I'm going to mute my voice because there's a ceremony going on outside my window.
All right. Any other comments or questions? I think overall everybody felt that it was feasible, and unless anybody has any other questions or comments, I think we can probably move on. Okay. And then I think the next one is also mine, if I can.
Yes, 1480.
Yeah, I'm trying to find it on my sheet here, down towards the bottom. And get it open here. Right. So this is the one that is stewarded by Ingenix. So it's patients 18 years of age and older on a beta blocker admission or within 7 days of discharge, interesting, or within 7 days of discharge of an isolated CABG procedure. So I think looking at this, actually, Carol, I'm going to let you start.
Okay. Well, the thing that concerned me here was in the data they presented, they had a population of 15 million members, and they only found 700 people with a CABG. So I thought about it a bit. Their database included, I think, only people up to age 65, which
mm-hmm.
is tend to lower the numbers.
Exactly.
I looked at our HEDIS results, and HEDIS stratifies by age. So I actually have some comparison numbers. For our HMO population, which is about 800,000 members, in 2008, we had 416 CABGs, patients with a CABG age 45 to 64. And in 2009, we had 401.
Mm-hmm.
So in less than a million members, we got more than half of their population. Now, another factor that may be a consideration here, and I suspect, as I thought about it some more, what may be part of the issue is that a lot of commercially insured patients don't have a pharmacy benefit or don't have a pharmacy benefit through the primary insurer. It often is carved out.
Right.
And so out of the 15 million people in the Ingenix database, they may have only had 2 million with pharmacy data or something like that. So there's 700, and they probably only, probably was a requirement in their criteria that you have a pharmacy benefit since they were looking for pharmacy claims.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the explanation may be that it isn't really 15 million people that we're looking at in their sample data. It may really be, a much smaller number. But it just struck me, that made me suspect of the whole measure. You know, if you can't find the people, something's not working right. And so, the explanation may be in the number with the pharmacy benefit, but I think we'd want some additional detail. Because if you're not finding most of the people who have the procedure, then the whole measure just isn't very meaningful.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. And I it's funny because the group was pretty split on whether this was even reasonable to move forward with. It looked like it was a 3-3 vote. And I think that it's a good idea, but there are problems with the data. People have comments clearly about whether this is, because it's a proprietary database, whether it's really useful. And I'm not sure who actually uses it. And you're only capturing a small part of the population. So I would agree. I think this is a bit of an issue to talk about.
Yeah. And, I think, and there's sort of two sides to that. One is that realistically, to report this measure, you have to hire Ingenix to do it because
mm-hmm.
they've got so much logics and so much, stuff around it. On the other hand, if you happen to be a customer of Ingenix, if it's got the NQF seal of approval, that's a really nice thing. So I could see both sides of that particular, issue.
Yeah. Anyone else have any other comments? We can kind of move forward. I think that'll all be a good discussion when we get together.
I guess my comment would be that it is a very interesting route to pursue because of the fact that it implies prescriptions that have been filled as opposed to prescriptions that have
mm-hmm.
been written. So that conceptually, that's very useful. The other tough thing about going to claims data for something like CABG is the difference in definition. The population defined for CABG from insurance claims never lines up that well with isolated CABG as defined by the FPS. In this case, that shouldn't make very much difference. But it is a general reservation that I think the STS would probably express about using definitions that are not quite as clean to define the population. So
And the other side of that, and again, with anything, there's multiple sides. From the perspective of a health plan, for example, having measures, from the health plan perspective, we do have claims data, and for those people with a pharmacy benefit, we do have pharmacy data. Having measures that can be run using those data sources that are available is incredibly useful. Now, this is a measure that, for example, for a provider or for a physician, looking at their own data would probably not be useful because they don't have those data sources. But having, there's enough measures now from NQF. Not every measure needs to be, I think it's okay to have some measures that are useful for a hospital to use about itself, some that are useful for a health plan to use, to look at providers. So having measures that use different data sources, I think can be a good thing. The question here is this the right measure?
Well, I wouldn't disagree with that at all. I think that's absolutely true. The thing that it does, though, on the harmonization front is it does create sometimes a cacophony of information when the information doesn't harmonize.
Right.
Yeah, this is looking at a very small subset of CABG patients because it excludes everybody over 65, and that is probably a biased population, in that I'm not sure you can extrapolate from under 65 CABGs to over 65 CABGs.
And actually, I think the measure itself is 18 and over. I think the data, the database that Ingenix used in the data they submitted included only people under age 65, as I recall. But the measure itself, I believe, is everyone 18 and over.
Oh, up to 65.
Is it just up to 65?
Yes.
Okay.
So they exclude, let's see.
So the measure title is 18 and over.
Right. Oh, I see what it says. It says, so benefits, measure identifies patients 18 years and older, but then when you go down into the 1B2, it says using geographically diverse 15 million member benchmark database, this database represents predominantly a commercial population less than 65 years of age.
But that's where they pulled their reports from.
Right.
But that's sort of like on some of the other measures, you know, somebody may have picked five hospitals to look at or something like that. I think here they used a database that they had to run some data, but the measure is written for 18 and over.
That is correct, and that's the way it's labeled.
Yeah.
But it sounds low, like their database would still end up limiting that. If they have people in the database, they would capture them.
Well, from what they say later on, and again, here, you know, lots of questions.
Yeah.
It sounds like Ingenix, and I'm not real familiar with how they work. It sounds like they had this test database. It also sounds like they may provide software to other customers, because they talked later or in one of the other documents about how the measure is used in a lot of places, but they don't have access to the information. And so it may be that they sell the software and their customers use the data. So I don't think that the measure is necessarily just written for this one database, but this was a database that they had to run the measure on for some sample data.
That may very well be.
This is Laura, the developer.
Mm-hmm.
That is true. The proprietary database that we're talking about, we use for testing and creating the measure. And you're right, it's predominantly patients under the age of 65, but our measure is not written to exclude patients over 65.
Great. And Laura, one other question for you, and it gets at the numerator again.
Mm-hmm.
When we were talking earlier, we were all assuming that everybody had to have had filled a prescription, but actually looking at the details, they don't necessarily all have to have filled it. I'm looking at 2A3. Number one, the patient filled a prescription, so that's what we've been talking about. But then 2 and 3 are actually claims with a code. So it might have been that they had them prescribed, but it doesn't mean that they actually got them. Is that correct?
There'd be a claim if they didn't fill it.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I was just trying to find the
283 on page 5 of the submission.
I don't seem to have that section in front of me right now, because you're seeing 2A?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. I would have to, I'd have to follow through on that. I'd have to check up on that. It's, you know, perhaps if there was medication given in a physician's office, that you could have a claim for that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't actually even know there were CPT codes for beta blocker treatment prescribed.
Yeah, so that's what I believe it's referring to.
So potentially they could have it prescribed but not necessarily fill it?
No, I think it's that it was like either given in a doctor's office or given in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
That 4006F code is a CPT-2 code, and
mm-hmm.
and the doctor puts that on a claim to indicate that they prescribed the medication.
Right.
It has nothing to do with whether it actually was filled or not.
That was my
okay.
understanding as well.
Yeah. That's the way that CPT-2 code works. So it could be either filled, as documented by a prescription being
right.
filled, or a code being submitted indicating that it was prescribed.
And that's the way number two, right above that three, reads.
Mm-hmm. So that makes this even kind of a messier. It's not as clear as we would have liked it to have had them all have had a filled prescription.
Okay, well, I will definitely bring that back to confirm.
All right. Anyone else have any questions on scientific acceptability? If not, I'll discuss my my issue.
Well, one thing that I would just note that Ingenix will need to do at the steering committee meeting is speak to, when they introduce the measure, the proprietary database and the requirement for being able to extract information to use that database.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's really not that anyone would be using our proprietary database. They would be using their own data and using our rules to extract what they need.
Okay. So then you'll speak to what the requirements are to obtain the rules?
Well, we put the rules out in the public domain, the ones that are endorsed by NQS.
Okay, so I think you'll just want to make that clear in your introduction of the measure.
Okay, absolutely.
The other thing I think would be important to convince me about this would be to know from that 15 million people in the database how many had a pharmacy benefit. If out of the 15 million it's 2 million that have a pharmacy benefit, then the denominator probably is reasonable. If you've got 10 million out of the 15 million who have a pharmacy benefit, I'm going to need some real convincing to believe you're finding all the people who had a bypass.
Okay.
And then the only other question that I had gets to the denominator exclusions and why you excluded patients who died during the admission. Because they may have gotten beta blockers appropriately or they may not have. I don't know. That may just be a small number and not make a difference.
But this is really looking at discharge medication. And they count medication before the admission in case you had a prescription for 90 days worth before that gets counted. But if somebody died, they don't have a discharge. You wouldn't give them a medication at discharge if they died.
Right, but it says at admission, so the measure is at admission or within 7 days.
Right, but I think the intent here, at least as I understand it, is they're really looking at was the patient discharged with medication.
Oh, that may be.
But if you had the prescription when you came in, you probably still have pills at home to take when you get home, so you wouldn't get a new prescription for them to find.
Right, right.
But I think they're really looking at were you discharged on the medicine, because the hospital can't impact whether you were taking it before you came in or not. It's just that also counts as a way of assuming you kept taking it after you left. So I can understand why they excluded the people who died.
And then the only other thing I would say is I didn't see any disparity data. Did anybody else? I went through everything. It says the measure wasn't stratified. I certainly think that would be something nice to know if you have that data.
And they just say does not apply. So they obviously, it would appear that they haven't looked at that.
Right, you're referring to race, ethnicity, and
yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, we don't. We don't
collect that data.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. All right. Everybody happy with the discussion on scientific acceptability? We can.
Could you summarize it for us? I guess just a couple points I'd throw in is that if this is not sort of augmenting other measures by getting some insight into prescriptions filled, as I think we now understand it does not.
Right.
has these vagaries about the denominator. We're not confident that the denominator is represented well. It seems like a fairly not a terribly huge increment over other existing measures, except insofar as it can be run from claims data, I guess would be the only real increment.
Yeah, that would be my comment. And in fact, I made a comment about that in the next section, essentially that given all of that, and it's based only on patients having insurance, whether this is really applicable to the general population and how usable is it really?
Well, we were thinking of this as more of a companion measure and not to replace other currently endorsed measures.
So I think that then brings up, I think that actually illustrates everybody's point. What does it add to the other measures that are already available?
Okay. Well, what we think is that we believe it brings three important concepts of added value. Mentioned before, we use a different data source, the STS registry data. The STS uses registry, and we use claims data, and that, you know, claims data are highly good at capturing prescriptions filled. And we believe our measure will capture patient beta blocker use very well. We are sensitive to the issue that that some patients don't fill their prescriptions using insurance. And, for example, if you go to Walmart and you get the generic for a couple of dollars. So we will include the ability to use SNOMED codes to capture drug use from other sources. The second point is that we look at a different aspect of care and measure a different part of the care process continuum. Since STS measure uses registry data, it takes more of a provider-centric approach, and it's capturing physicians' prescription ordering behavior, while our measure is more patient-centric, since it's capturing a patient's medication filling behavior. And this
it really isn't, is it?
Right.
It's capturing that plus physician ordering behavior.
I'm going to go back and I'm going to double check on that. But we certainly could think about how we could correct that if that's an issue. If we really just wanted to get at patient prescription behavior. The third thing is that our measure increases the ability to capture performance more accurately. The data in the STS registry is voluntarily reported, and this could possibly lead towards some biased results, since those providers doing things well would be the ones who are more likely to voluntarily report their data. Our measure uses administrative claims data, which is routinely collected for reimbursement and is not voluntarily reported, and that this could, you know, help get at a less biased answer.
Does anybody know how often are CPT-2 codes being used now?
I can tell you from our claims that we receive, it's not real common.
That's what I thought.
But, you know, it probably varies by provider.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, overall we don't see a huge, huge percent. The, you know, and I would want to just say, too, from a health plan perspective, having good measures that can be run using claims data is extremely valuable. I'm not sure this is the right measure, but, you know, even though there are other measures based on registry data or based on hospital, you know, collected data, you know, I think an administrative measure is a different measure and does have real value. So I wouldn't throw something out just because it's similar to something that requires medical record review, because their health plans really do need good measures to work with.
I would agree with that. I think everybody does. I think that.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I know this is not our measure, but there was something that was spoken about the STS measure being voluntary, and I wanted to correct that so people didn't take that message away. The discharge beta blocker field is actually mandatory for submission of cases, and so it's actually not voluntary.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to put that in there for the record.
But I think the notion is that the submission to the STS is voluntary.
Right.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was referring to.
Right, which I definitely understand. But as Dr. Shaheen, I'm sure, will strongly state when he's at the steering committee, we do capture 95% of hospitals that perform isolated CABG. So I just wanted to mention that as well.
Right.
I didn't want you to take away that I think you have a very good measure. I didn't mean to imply anything otherwise, and that our hope, like I said, was to be a companion measure.
Oh, no, I definitely understand. I just wanted to make sure that everybody took away a clear message about everything, just to make sure we're on the same page.
All right. Well, we got so bogged down in the discussion. Let's see. How far did we get? So we were talking. So we got through scientific acceptability. Pretty much have been talking about usability in terms of proprietary database, insurance benefits, whether it's generalizable, harmonizing with other measures. Looks like Paula had a question about public reporting. She's not available to us, so I'm not sure what. Can you tell us? Do you all publicly report this, or does it only go to healthcare plans?
You mean with respect to the proprietary database?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Yeah, we don't. The only thing that we do with the proprietary database is use it to test and build our measures. We don't report from it. You know, customers use their own data and process it through the measures.
And so it's essentially internal benchmarking.
Yes. Actually, our customers do have access to benchmark results so that they can compare their population to the population that's in our database, and they get that for free.
All right. Anybody else have any other comments?
The one other thing I would say is under usability, understandability of the measures was based, you know, the data there is based on a survey of two customers. I hardly think that two customers represent the general population.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was a particularly weak section. So just wanted to make that comment.
All right. If there are no other comments, we'll go on to feasibility. Again, it looks pretty much like the group was split. Mostly discussion about, again, the proprietary process being removed from the outcome and the numbers of people in the database. I don't really have anything more to add than I already said in all of my other comments. All right. Any other comments or questions? Right, I think we can move on then. What measure is up next?
365, Dr. Detton.
Yep, I am here. And I don't have my comments in front of me, so you may have to remind me what I wrote down. But my overall on these is, why do we need two measures here? If surgical volume is a surrogate for mortality, why not just measure mortality, which is the other measure? So that would be one question for the developers. Other than that, my take on the usability, feasibility of the measure, it's easy to measure. Both of these numbers are readily available. They're easy to collect. They're not particularly subject to bias. So I had very few concerns on that score. It was just the overall question of, why do we need both a surrogate and a real measure?
And that's one, you know, as I thought about that, I can kind of understand in that, for so many hospitals, the number of procedures is very small, And if you've got a denominator of 10, or even if you have a denominator of 20, you know, if you have 20 and you happen to miss having anybody die, your mortality rate is zero. And so you look really good, but it's still such a small sample. If you have 10 and you happen to not have anybody die that year, or 5 and you don't have anybody die that year, the numbers may look pretty good, but it may have just been by chance. Also, if it seems here, and I'm certainly not the expert on pancreatic resection, but it seems like the volume is, you know, may not be a perfect indicator, but it seems like it's one that's really relatively easy to measure. It's a little more prospective than mortality rate, which I would guess would fluctuate for a given hospital. If you're doing 10 a year, say, or 5 a year, or 20 a year, you may very well have big fluctuations in mortality rate from year to year based on that small denominator. And my hunch is that the volume is probably going to be a little more stable of an indicator. So I could kind of understand why there's both.
Well, I actually put a comment into the next one about the volume, and I actually think that measure is actually superfluous, and I would harmonize the two, and have mortality stratified by volume and have it reported that way, rather than two separate measures for people to look at.
What do you mean by stratified by volume? You would report high volume, medium, and low volume institutions?
Exactly. Because I think as a, you know, so again, it depends on who you're developing the measure for. If I was a patient, and I was going to look at, you know, at a center's, dashboard to figure out what their mortality rate was, for a pancreatic resection, if you're smart enough, you know, it's not just your rate. It's the rate for how many you did.
Well,
so if they only did two and they both survived, well, that's great for that time period, but that may just be a sampling bias.
So I'd put in a plug for reporting both, and
yeah.
And it's for much the same reasons have been stated for those that have spoken in favor of reporting both. And I think actually the number is not 10. I think there are a lot of hospitals that are one or two or three. And there is actually a classic Dartmouth paper that shows that a zero mortality rate for pancreatic resection, being one of the operations chosen, is predictive of average to below average mortality rate in future samples, for exactly the reason that we're discussing,
right.
Is that it's more closely associated with a small sample size than anything else. And I think to explicitly state the very low volume institutions, because this is an operation where there are places that do hundreds, not very many. Then there's a lot of places that do one or two. And I think to sort of explicitly separate volume from outcome is worthwhile, because so many of the one or twos are going to have 0% mortality, and the public will falsely feel reassured by that number. And it really is not a very good number for predicting what lies ahead.
Right, and I think for me the question is, do you have two separate measures, or do you harmonize them and report both in the same measure?
I guess as long as the volume number is in the mortality measure, that would be just fine. It might potentially make for a more confusing statistic, I guess. But certainly you'd want them in conjunction with one another. I would agree that they should be coupled in some way.
Is anybody from AHRQ on the call?
Yeah, this is John Bott with AHRQ. And
John.
This exact question came up with the esophageal resection mortality measure with the steering committee a few weeks back, exact same discussion. And I would really just myself defer to Patrick Romano and Jeff Geppert, who will be much more able to converse in this conversation than myself when we meet in a couple of weeks. But I'll just say that this is a paired measure where the recommendation is to report both measures, and Patrick and Jeff will, again, do a much better job of representing and defending both measures at that time.
Great. That's helpful.
One concern that I had about this measure was the numerator time window. The denominator says it can be, the time window can be determined by the user, but is generally a calendar year. Okay, that makes sense to me for the denominator. But the numerator time window is has those same words in there, and it seems like for looking at mortality, that you would be looking at, you know, during the hospitalization or during 30 days or during 7 days, or, you know, that it would be some kind of a... So that numerator definition or the numerator time frame just didn't seem appropriate to me.
Yeah, this is John Bott. All of our quality indicators are measuring care during that hospitalization. So it's, if you choose a year period of time for the denominator, then it's the, you know, it's the same period of time for those cases in the numerator. So it is inpatient mortality, and maybe we should, now with the advent recently of 30-day measures, we should probably change the name of measures to inpatient mortality.
Right, but on the form under 2A2, I mean, the numerator time window would be the time frame during which you're looking at mortality. And right now it says you're looking at mortality for a calendar year. And I don't think that's when you're looking at mortality. If you're looking at the during the inpatient period, that would be the time window for the numerator.
Yeah, I see what you mean. That we could have responded better in that for that question.
And I think it is an important thing because it could be 30 days. It could be all kinds of things.
Yeah, yeah. Point well taken.
All right. I can't, as I say, I can't see the screen. I don't have my papers in front of me. So were there any other significant comments mentioned, Alexis or Melinda?
So I have a question. It's Renee. If we go on to scientific acceptability, I was curious why the pancreatic resection code had to included only a resection for cancer. Why would it exclude resection for benign lesions or for pancreatitis?
That's a great question for Dr. Patrick Romano. He'll be able to explain that much better than I couldn't provide the rationale. I'm sorry.
Okay, great. Well, and I think that's something that's really important because a number of patients end up going to the operating room for what's thought to be cancer, and they turn out to be benign. And so if you're going by your final code, then you would exclude somebody who had a pancreatic resection in your numerator and your denominator, for that matter, in your numerator. So it'd be nice to know that. That was the only other question I had on that. And again, all the citations are old, and it says that they'll be updated, but it'd really be nice to have those in the submission because then we have to go back and look at all the newer ones. Just adds a lot of extra time.
And Dr. Dutton, you had a note that transfer patients are excluded from both numerator and denominator, and asked the question about whether or not essentially somebody could improve their results by transferring the patient to another hospital before they die.
Yeah, that's not merely speculative. I mean, lots of academic centers and tertiary care centers get this kind of patient transferred to them all the time, often very sick and often dies. And it seems like those should be accounted for somewhere.
I would second that.
Okay, so that'll go forward for Dr. Romano as well.
And my suggestion to the developer would be that in the numerator, a patient who has a pancreatic resection and is transferred to another acute care hospital should count just like they died.
Okay, so we'll have that one for Dr. Romano, and Dr. Dutton, you'll make that recommendation at the steering committee or that comment?
Sure.
Great. So then if you want to look at usability, there were just a couple of comments. Leapfrog and ARC measures should be harmonized. Risk adjustment in ARC measure is appropriate. And that was Renee's comment. And your comment was appears to have performed well as an indicator of system quality.
Yeah, that was based on the submitted material.
Yeah, and it's Renee. I don't really have anything more to say than I've already said about it. So.
Okay.
And I'm good, too.
Okay, so then feasibility, there was only one comment, and that, Dr. Dutton, was yours, concern over scoring of transferred patients. That, I assume, is what you've spoken to?
Yep.
And then your final comment was the one you just made about exclusion of patients transferred to acute care hospitals in the numerator.
Right.
So, any other... Other comments? Ready to go to 273?
Oh, one thing before we move on to 273 is on 366, and I think mostly the comments are the same, but I did notice that in section 2B and 2C that somebody had done a cut and paste and gave information about esophageal resection and not about pancreatic surgery.
Yeah, I noted that as well.
Yeah, four of us did.
So, you know, I'd say get it cleaned up.
Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to bypass 366. I was thinking you were discussing the two of them together. So,
I think we were. I think pretty much we've probably covered most of the information, but I just wanted to make sure Art got that feedback.
Yeah, thanks for that feedback. We'll correct that.
And then the other issue with this measure, it's Renee, is that the measure is the number of discharges with the procedure for pancreatic resection, and it does not specify cancer like the other one did. So the two measures are different.
If they're going to be paired, they need to be harmonized.
Exactly. So either it's all pancreatic resection or it's all just cancer, but they need to clean all that up.
Yeah, again, the exact same comment came up with the esophageal resection, and that Patrick Romano will speak to that.
So I'm sorry, Dr. Dutton, do you feel that you're ready to move on, or do you want to...
I think everything has been said about this that needs to be said.
Okay. Does anybody else have any other comments about 366? And, again, I apologize for...
No, nothing else.
I'm good.
Okay. So then 273, and Alexis, did you say that John Morton is was not going to be available?
Yes.
Okay, so 273 is perforated appendix admission rate. And John Morton is the one who said that this was not important. And there's not a comment or rationale for that. Everyone else identified it as important. So any discussion you want to have with respect to importance?
Well, I could hypothesize about why he might have said it wasn't important. There's a whole lot of gray area in this. Because of the way the actual measure is labeled, the percentage of admissions for appendicitis with the perforated appendix doesn't tell you whether, how would you know it was present on admission when they came in, or did they get admitted with no CT scan, so you don't know if they were perforated, and then you operated on them several days later. So it's not a clean, the definition isn't clean, and that would be the one thing that I would suggest that might not be a good thing about this measure. Because I couldn't tell what they were actually trying to get at in the overall scheme of things for this measure. Was it access to the hospital?
Well, this is one of the prevention indicators, one of ARC's prevention indicators, and they basically aren't looking at the hospital care, but at, you know, basically what could have happened before you came to the hospital, you know. And so I think, and then again, speaking from a health plan perspective, I think it's one of the pieces of information that we have that's really helpful. But if a hospital has a high perforation rate, you know, is it because the patient stayed at home for a few weeks and felt sick and didn't do anything? Is it that they went to the doctor and the doctor didn't do the right thing and didn't bother to look into it? Is it that the patient sat in the hospital for a week before anybody bothered to do anything? You know, there's all kinds of possibilities, many of which have nothing to do with the healthcare system. But in terms of understanding the health of the population and sort of what's going on, this is a useful indicator. It's just not useful, I don't think, for saying, oh, this is a good hospital or this is a bad hospital. It's more the community, I think, that's being assessed than the, you know, the whole system, including the patient, than the care of a provider.
Yeah.
And I get that. And if you actually look at 2A under the care settings and clinical services, you know, they defined it as ambulatory care. But that assumes that people have access to a physician to go to, and that they actually go to a physician's office before they show up in the emergency room. I guess I just don't understand how the measure would really accurately reflect something in terms of what they're trying to look at. I understand why they want to look at it. I'm just not sure it's the right measure.
I think this, as I recall, and I'm trying to remember, and John will know, but I think this is really designed, isn't it, to report by, like, county or by city or by state as opposed to by provider.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. The measure is typically used. The typical use is a state executes the measure, and they're looking at variation in care in various counties. It's also looked at the state level and a number of national reports that look at how states are doing from state to state. So the denominator is a state or a county or a zip code, typically.
Gotcha.
And, yeah, the numerator is assigned not to the hospital but to the person's place of residence.
Okay, so any other discussion?
Well, I guess I'd say I would conclude from that then that the concerns that were raised, it really doesn't matter if the perforation occurs prior to admission, after admission, during a hospitalization. It's basically what percentage of appendices are found to be perforated at surgery, and that's reflective of the whole sort of spectrum of care that was potentially received prior to the operation, and there might be important geographic variations in that. Is that a reasonable way to state it?
I think so. It's kind of looking at the whole system,
mm-hmm.
including the patient, and not just the healthcare system.
Right.
So then it would be actionable in what way?
Well, I think that actionable is the question. It would at least give you a place to drill down on discrepancies. How actionable that would be is hard to say, because at what level you'd be actionable about it is another, you know, is it a geographic distribution of primary care practices? Is it socioeconomic status? People don't have insurance, so they don't go. You know, I think the actionable question is a good one, and I'm not sure that what exactly the answer to that is.
Well, I think if a state, you know, say a state had a horrible rate compared to everybody else, I think that does raise the question of, okay, what is the problem? Do we not have enough doctors? Do we not mm-hmm. have enough hospitals? Do we not have educated enough patients? Are the hospitals we have not doing a good job? I mean, I think it does, for a state or county with a really horrible rate, it does say we've got a problem here, we should pay attention to it.
Right.
Okay, are you ready to move on to scientific acceptability? There were actually four people who indicated it was partially met, two completely. Renee, you had a comment, and Dr. Dutton, you had a comment.
Unfortunately, my whole comment isn't on the spreadsheet.
Okay, so
click on the cell. You can read it up at the top.
Let's see. Oh, I just had to, again, it was actually the same comment that you had made earlier. The numerator and denominator time windows weren't consistent. That was the same comment we had for one of the other ARC. And then I already talked about the benchmarking issue, so nothing new.
Okay. And Dr. Dutton, your comment was that the measure is specifically designed to identify disparities in care. Statistics become fairly complex because of the odd denominator, well-defined.
What Dr. Torch said was fine with that.
Okay, so are you ready to go to usability? Two people said partially, the others said completely, and Dr. Dutton, you had a note that the measure is hard to understand and interpret.
Yes, but I think I have that now.
Okay. So any other discussion from other members of the group? If not, then feasibility. Had a 50-50 split on partially versus completely, and Dr. Dutton, you said depends on HCUP SID sample with all the risks and benefits of administrative data that is implied. With the overall comment being reinforcing what the group has already said in terms of it being useful for identifying areas of practice variation worth further investigation, not as useful for individual hospitals or practitioners.
Right. It just took me a while to get around the concept. This was a very different measure than all the other ones we asked.
Other comments, discussion about any of the elements or the measure as a whole?
Nope.
Okay, you want to go on then to 364. And 364 is incidental appendectomy in the elderly as a rate, a risk-adjusted rate.
And I have problems with this measure, and I'm certainly not a surgeon, don't know all the literature, but from what was in the write-up, the references were all old, you know, quite old, and basically from what I could read from what was in the write-up, old data showed that if the elderly who had a cholecystectomy also had their appendix removed, they were more likely to have infection. Then the measure included a whole bunch of procedures that in addition to cholecystectomy, so it didn't seem to be totally based on the literature. And then in addition to that, the time frame from all of those old studies would have been, I think, before antibiotic prophylaxis was routinely given, which made me wonder if the old data is even relevant. So, you know, I have no vested interest either way in this. I'm not real familiar with all the details, but based on what was written up, I had trouble understanding why we would care about this.
Yeah, I thought this was a pretty well, I thought it was a very old or very dated measure based on very limited data. And I think it's well accepted in the surgical community now that you don't do this.
Exactly.
So it's a little like having a measure based on not setting the patient on fire. There's not much point because we already know we shouldn't do that.
You know, I would agree with that, but it's interesting. It is, but yet when you look at the performance gap data, it's pretty significant. I was actually surprised.
And from the data that's presented, I couldn't make a good case for myself that it was a bad idea. I mean, and again, I'm not a surgeon, don't know, but I really wondered, is this something that's become a part of practice and that everybody's used to, that it's the right wisdom, but is it the right wisdom? I didn't even know.
Yeah, right. So the issue with doing an incidental appendectomy for, if you're in the belly for some other procedure, it's the risk of wound infection is the big thing. That's the main reason to not do it. Say you're doing a cholecystectomy, that's not a dirty case. You're not going into the gut. And if you do an appendectomy, you're potentially releasing organisms from the gut.
Right.
So that, you know, that's the rationale. And the standard is to not do it, incidentally anymore. And if you look at the rates that they gave in 1B2, I was really surprised to see that there were rates as high as 21 per thousand. And that's as of 2007. So I was a little surprised, actually, to see that.
It's a process measure, though, that's a long way from the outcome.
That's true.
And maybe the 2% where they did it, there was a good reason for doing it, like the patient asked for it, or there was something else going on with that case that we'll never know from the administrative data. It just seemed like there was very little value to this.
I agree, and I said the same thing in terms of we really need updated data and references. It's hard to make any other conclusion based on what we have.
And a lot of the cases in the denominator for this measure aren't clean procedures. A cholecystectomy is a clean procedure. But the other things that they have in here, there's a lot of intestinal stuff and,
right.
You know, a lot of things. And again, in the day of prophylactic antibiotics, have the facts changed? I have no idea, but it just, I don't know. There seem to be lots of questions.
So then in terms of scientific acceptability, anything to add to the discussion you just had to address the question? All but one person had identified it was not important, and then with scientific acceptability, mostly, partially, and minimally. There's only one completely. So anything else you want to speak to about that?
Not for me.
Then, hearing no one else, usability?
Almost seems moot if it's not of any value scientifically.
Okay, so is the group comfortable with leaving the discussion there?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay, so then you're ready to move on to 265. And that's Carol Wilhoit.
Okay, so this one is the rate of ambulatory surgery center admissions requiring a hospital transfer or hospital admission upon discharge from the ambulatory surgery center. And the first category is important. And let's see, under importance, Renee, you had a comment.
Yeah, it was pretty much what you said. In 4D, no data on reliability. I think multiple data sources may be a problem. And then there was, I'm sorry, I'm way over on the other side. Hang on just a second. Here we go. Let's see. Said it seems to be clearly useful for internal benchmarking. It's unclear whether it's useful for public reporting, given the low rates that were associated with the measure. That was my concern about whether it was valuable and how it was going to be used.
I think it's a critical measure for quality management at the facility level.
That I would agree with.
Anything else on importance? Then we move to scientific acceptability. And the concern I had here was whether it was measuring the right thing. It basically measured whether a patient was transferred from the ambulatory surgery center to a hospital. But if a patient goes home for 10 minutes or an hour and then goes to the hospital, it doesn't count. And so I wondered if it was really building in sort of a perverse system where people who really should be admitted, if this were publicly reported, wouldn't there be a perverse motive to send people home and tell them to go to the ER if they're worse rather than transferring them if you thought they needed to be admitted? So I was really concerned about whether it was measuring the right thing.
I would agree with that. I think the much better measure is readmission or admission within 24 hours.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that sure seemed to me like there should be some time window, and, you know, what the right time window is, I don't know. 24 hours seems reasonable, might even be less than that. But it just seemed like the wrong time frame. And then I also noticed it looked like, in terms of the scientific acceptability, there were two different denominators, and it wasn't clear why they were, you know, I couldn't tell if somebody was playing games or and picking and choosing or if it all made sense. And also some of the decimal places seemed wrong, so I wasn't, you know, I think they had a wrong decimal place, which made things look a little different than they probably are as well. So they talked about the mean and the median as being 0.1%, but I think looking at the whole picture, I think it was probably 1%, and that's a pretty big difference. So, you know, it's something else we can ask. I don't know if the developer's on the phone.
I think not.
Okay.
Correct, Alexis?
No, I don't think Donna's present on the phone.
So 1% would be more right.
Yeah, man, and that seemed to fit with the data, but they expressed it as 0.1. And then, Renee, looked like you had a comment.
Yeah, I think it's pretty much been cleared up. Mm-hmm. More was just about benchmarking and things than anything else.
Okay. Then in terms of usability, looks like a lot of the comments was kind of made. The other thing in terms of usability, you know, again, their interpretability for public reporting was based on a survey of 8 nurses who work in ambulatory surgery centers. That hardly seemed like...
Yeah, that left me pretty cold, yeah.
So that was another, you know, another thing I noticed. And then under feasibility, see, Renee, you had a comment.
Yeah, I just wasn't, it didn't, at least based on the data that was provided, it, for me it wasn't clear that there was a large performance gap. And again, it kind of gets to the issues about what is it really measuring. And it might be better to have a measure that looked at readmission or admission within 24 hours would be a more likely measure to look at.
Okay. Okay.
I completely agree with that in the sense that also to some degree, and this may be defined in the measure in more detail, but if an ASC is sort of physically connected to the hospital, you might put patients in there that have a reasonable probability of being admitted directly afterwards that you would never put in an ASC that was, you know, 10 miles away in a much more freestanding location. And that wouldn't really be a quality problem. The quality problem would be in the patients that were discharged from either place after and got sent home and then got readmitted. So I definitely agree with the idea that it's the admissions within a defined period that's more important than the direct admissions.
Okay. So I think that probably gives us a number of things to talk about at the meeting. You know, it seems like this is getting at something important, but whether it's quite there or not seems like the issue.
Well said.
Okay, then the other one that I had is 1519, which is statin therapy at discharge after lower extremity bypass. And this is looking at patients 18 and older who have infrainguinal lower extremity bypass who are prescribed a statin at discharge. And in terms of importance, think pretty much was rated relatively highly. The one comment here is, again, the question of does the fact that somebody got a prescription mean they filled it, you know, and so that's certainly an open issue. Any other thoughts in terms of importance? Okay, then in terms of scientific acceptability, let's see. Renee, you had a comment.
Yeah, and it was essentially the same for the most part as yours. Kind of shoring up the denominator and numerator time windows. They're not really consistent.
Yeah, they weren't making any sense.
Yeah, it didn't make any sense to me at all, actually.
Right. Yeah, and they were listed as being lifetime for provider reporting and annual for hospital reporting,
right,
which doesn't tell you anything. So that, I thought, was really confusing. And is anybody from the Society for Vascular Surgery on the call? I guess we can't raise that now, but that certainly was a question. And then
I think the other comment that I made that I think is important is that I didn't see any disparity data. And we know there's disparity with respect to beta blocker use and other pharmaceutical agents. And these patients are the same patients that get their CABGs. So I would like to see some disparity data if they have it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then Richard, you had a comment about Measure methodology should be presented in publicly accessible format that does not require participation in any particular registry.
Yeah, the same as we had said at our last meeting about the STS stuff, is they need to present it as a generic measure. This one I thought was a little too based on having to participate in this registry.
Okay. Anything else in terms of scientific acceptability? Okay, then in terms of usability, it looks like for one of the questions, a number of us listed N, and I'm not sure, 3B, can't tell what the question was on that one. Alexis, do you know what that one is?
I'm sorry.
The question was on 3B.
It's like 3B is harmonization.
In the write-up it is, but in the questions I think it was something else, but I can't tell what from the spreadsheet. Don't know. Maybe it was. So anybody have any comments in terms of usability?
I just thought this whole section wasn't necessarily very clearly written. I wasn't quite sure what they were. They said that it was harmonized, and it says yes, but I don't know with what. And then the 3C thing was distinctive or additive value, and it says different patient population. Again, different patient population from what? I didn't actually put those comments in, but that's what I was.
Yeah, and I saw that, and I had wondered, and I assumed it was that there's measures for, like, heart-related things, and this was vascular, and that was the different patient population?
I suspect probably so.
That was my guess. It certainly wasn't clearly written.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, and then in terms of feasibility, I noticed that the measure was defined in terms of medical record documentation, and, you know, they base it on use of a registry, and the registry would be coming out of the medical record, but without the registry, you know, the fact that it requires medical record documentation would require a big, big burden of data collection. And I don't know, some of the rest of you may be familiar with, you know, how many participants are there in these two registries that they mentioned? Are they common? Are they not common? I don't have any good sense.
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head.
But, you know, that might make a difference in terms of realistically how feasible these measures are, because with medical record review, it's a big burden unless you've got a good number of participants. And even somebody else talked about the cost. I guess, Renee, you talked about the cost to participate in abstract data.
Mm-hmm.
A similar kind of issue that you'd raise. So then overall, it looks like 4 people said feasibility was partially met, 2 completely met. So obviously, collectively, we had questions there. And then the other thing that I noticed is they based this on a guideline, and they said that the guideline supported the use of statins regardless of the LDL level. But then when they described it was in the guidelines, it didn't match that. And the guidelines that they cited were based on using a statin based on LDL. So it looked to me like there might be a disconnect, but I wasn't totally sure. And then, Dr. Dutton, you had a comment, although rough around the edges, this measure reflects important emerging knowledge and should be assessed for ability to improve care.
Yeah, I mean, I have no disagreement with the basic idea that patients should get statins, but the measure, as has already been said by everybody else, is not very well written.
So that's probably a pretty good summary. So any other thoughts on this measure? Okay. Alexis, I think that brings us to the end of the list.
Okay, great. We can now ask anyone on the phone, the public or NQF members, if they have any comments regarding today's discussion. Okay, seeing as there are no additional comments, I will go into next steps. Next week, most likely on Tuesday, we will be sending the committee a logistics memo outlining the format of the meeting. At the beginning of the meeting on the first day, we will finalize phase one measures. At that time, CMS will present the outcome of their expert panel meeting regarding measure 300, which was cardiac patients with controlled 6 a.m. postoperative glucose. And then following the discussion of that measure, the committee will then vote on recommending the measure for NQF endorsement. Also, we will finish voting on the 16 measures that were discussed on the March 31st call, and the committee decided to push voting to the in-person meeting, so we'll make sure that we vote on those measures. And then finally, the phase one measures that are competing and related, we'll have that discussion, and then we will vote on the measures that are currently under review based on the harmonization concerns and issues. And then following that, we will then begin to review and discuss and vote on the phase two measures. And on day two, we will discuss the phase two related and competing measures, as well as gaps in measurement. And if we do not get through the entire agenda, we will then survey you all for additional conference calls to make sure that we get through the review of the phase two measures and the phase two related and competing measures, as well as gaps in measurement. And on March 28th, Benita from our meetings department, she sent an email regarding travel and hotel accommodations and provided instructions on how to make your travel arrangements. And if you have not already done so, please submit your lodging request form to her ASAP. It was due on Tuesday the 19th. And if anyone did not receive that email, if you could let me know now, and I'll make sure that you get a copy of the email and the request form that needs to be submitted. Okay. Are there any questions about anything that I just went over? Okay, I'll turn it back over to Melinda.
If there's not anything further from the group, Dr. Torchiana, do you have any closing comments?
No, I look forward to seeing everybody in Washington.
Okay, so sorry that we did not finish early. I know people were hopeful that we could do so, but we do appreciate your time and the work you've put into this. Thank you so much, and see you soon.
Okay, right. Bye-bye.
Thanks, bye.
Bye.